Hi, everybody. It's 4 o'clock on Fantastic Sundays, Radio Free Brooklyn. We're crossing over a little bit here into a karaoke land, but I think we're going to be fine. This is Stephen Pitalo, and you're listening to Music Video Time Machine as part of Pack Rat Planet Radio. We're really, really happy to be here today, and our guest is going to be, in just a moment, the wonderful Rich Murray, who was a director and is still a director of music videos in the 1990s, made his way up the ladder, starting with the, let's say, the Philly hip hop world and far more. But what's really great is that he was right in the middle of it. And so that's what's one of the most wonderful things about this particular interview is that Rich has an incredible perspective about different areas of music video. He's the only person I've ever met who directed a music video for Roxanne Shanté and the Spin Doctors. So there you go. And ladies and gentlemen, Rich Murray. How are you today, Rich?
Pretty good, Stephen. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. Gosh, I don't even know where to start. Let's talk about where you got started. And I understand you were a student at Temple University, and your interest in broadcast, I believe, started there or probably even predated that. How did that come to be a part of your life?
Well, as you just mentioned, I was at Temple University's radio, television, and film department in the late 70s, early 80s. And, you know, it was the dawn of MTV. So, of course, the people that were in my class, we were there when it hit the air. So it was what we all aspired towards, was making a music video. It was happening. It was right in the moment, and it was something that seemed attainable. I was working as a projectionist at a repertory movie theater in Philadelphia, and a couple doors down, there was this sort of well-known rock club called Dobbs, which was a famous place in Philly where everybody from Nirvana to George Thorogood to you name it has passed through the doors. It just actually closed about 2 months ago. So at Dobbs, there was this act named Alan Mann. And Alan was kind of like, you know, the Friday, Saturday night attraction. He was, you know, maybe 8-10 years older than me. Quite honestly, I looked up to the guy and kind of had this sort of, you know, I'm a kid, you know, late teens, early 20s. I'm looking at this guy as my rock and roll hero. So I approached Alan and said, hey, I'd like to make a documentary about the Alan Mann Band. And he humored me and took me under his wing. And I hung out with him quite a bit. And he was right on the cusp of making it. There were, you know, live radio broadcast shows at all the big Philly clubs. I would trail around, follow him to all those shows. You know, I wasn't really organized enough at that point to successfully pull off getting that documentary made. But I didn't forget Alan, and he didn't forget me. So a couple years later, as I was graduating from Temple University's film school, I ran into Alan on a trolley in Philadelphia, and he said, hey, man, are you still doing that film thing? And, you know, I guess I had just gone to 5 years of film school. Yeah, I was. So I said, yeah, I'm still doing it. In fact, I'm getting ready to do a bunch of music videos. The bunch of music videos I was getting ready to make were all on paper and in my head pretty much. But he said, well, I got this new manager. He's going to come up with some money, and we have this song, this Christmas song, and my manager has some contacts, and I'm at MTV, and if we deliver it to them and, you know, in a few weeks, they say they're going to play it during the Christmas season. And this is 1983. I was a little skeptical, of course, even being as anxious and ready for a gig as I was. But, you know, I suspended disbelief, and I took a couple meetings with Alan and his new manager, and brought a really good friend of mine in on it, Deborah Kaminsky, who is now Deborah Bouginet, to produce. And next thing you know, we were directing a video with all the bells and whistles, with a big time, you know, commercial crew in Philadelphia with a real budget. And several weeks later, believe it or not, it was on MTV.
Now, What was the sort of the nuts and bolts of putting the crew together at that time, because it was such a sort of independent way of doing things?
I had no clue. Debbie was the first one in my crowd to get a job under professional circumstances, and actually had in 6 short months had worked her way up to coordinator. So she had contacts, and that was, you know, in addition to her being a very good friend of mine and really admiring her abilities. Honestly, I thought, well, she knows the people. So Debbie called the people she had just probably made a Procter Gamble commercial with the week before. You know, these were real professionals from the commercial Philadelphia scene. They weren't, by the way, mixed in with a few film students that I insisted have positions on the crew, much to people's dismay, because there was this question as to whether they were qualified enough to man those positions. But it was an interesting mix of people, and that's how we put it together. It was portion film students and portion professional Philadelphia commercial crew.
Now, where did things go from there?
Well, this is like the early 80s, and Alan's manager, a gentleman named Butch Shin, who was a colorful character. He was personal friends with Clarence Clemens and reputedly been Springsteen's road manager. You know, he was a tough North Jersey guy. And, I think the statute of limitations is over. I could say now that the video was paid for in cash, enormous amount of cash. He knew some people, as they say, up at MTV. And, you know, I think in those days, a lot of the people up at MTV were some of the people, at least at the executive end, not the VJs, but had come over from, 70s and 80s radio. And those were very old school guys, you know. That was like the initial – it was a video radio station. So these were people from his family of contacts, and he knew a few and was able to present it to the right person on the right day, get it into a programming meeting, and voila, it was on the air.
That's a pretty amazing story. Now, Alan Mann, it was the Alan Mann Band. It was Christmas on the Block.
The song was called Christmas on the Block, which is, by the way, still a staple on Philadelphia radio every Christmas season. I was down in I'm working on a documentary, which we can talk about maybe a little later on, backtrack, and talk about it some more. But I'm working on a documentary right now about Alan and my experiences with Alan and Alan's career, really, as a whole. And so I was in Philadelphia over the Christmas season working on that for the second consecutive year. And they play this song, Christmas on the Block, on Philly radio regularly. I mean, I heard it 3 times while I was down in Philadelphia, and this is 30-some years later. So, it's a local hero story. Christmas on the Block is definitely a local hero story in Philadelphia.
Well, fantastic. All right, well, let's take a listen to Alan Mann and Christmas on the Block.
Above the night, and it shines its gray light on the midnight air, and the houses twinkle on the block. But there's one house that shines a special way out there, and it's Christmas in the city, and the trees are lighted pretty. But the prettiest Christmas tree of all. All I see are the colors that we came out, and theirs is the most beautiful Christmas on the Block. Cannot see the light of day, and the night is forever, the facts still remain. In this world of confusion, there is peace. There is hope and despair. Sometimes the beauty is a beast, and they cannot see the lightning, and they cannot see the thunder, but they know what no one understands. That beauty is a blessing, love is all we get, and theirs is the most beautiful Christmas on the block. Darkest corner of the night, only dreams illuminate their eyes, and they see all the colors that we cannot, and this is the most beautiful Christmas on the block. See the lightning, and they cannot see the thunder, but they know what no one understands. The beauty is a blessing, love is all we got, and theirs is the most beautiful Christmas on the block.
Very sweet. That was Christmas on the Block by the Alan Mann Band, which was our guest Rich Murray's first music video. Now, how did you happen to transition from that into the world of Philly hip hop?
Well, you know, I was kind of working after that, trying to, you know, there weren't too many video gigs to be had in Philly in the early 80s. There were maybe three or four acts total that were signed. And I was lucky to get an opportunity to start producing videos for Philly World Records. I wasn't directing them, but I was writing them, editing them, and producing them. And it was a bunch of acts. It was Brian Loren, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And, you know, I made these videos. I made like four or five of them in the course of six, 7 months. And on one of them, I actually met this dude named Chris Schwartz, who was kind of, you know, just trying to get his start as well. And he was trying to hang out with some of the producer dudes, you know, some of the people that were producing the music, because that's where his, you know, his talents and his interests were at that point. And so he and I became roommates. So shortly thereafter, Chris started plugging himself into the Philly hip-hop scene. And he met this guy named Schoolie D. And Schoolie lived probably maybe 10 blocks from us in West Philadelphia. So Schoolie would come over to the house in a room much like where we're sitting right now, you know, makeshift recording studio in our house in West Philly. And he would Chris would help him do beats, because Chris had this electronic music band, so he had all these vocoders and keyboards that were very, you know, cutting edge for, you know, 1984 or so. So in the midst of all that, from, you know, Chris being immersed in the rising hip-hop culture in Philly, he met these two guys named Lawrence and Dana Goodman, who were the managers of this young rapper from New York named Roxanne Shanté. So it was really like in quick succession. I did a video for Roxanne Shanté and a very low budget video for Schooly D. The video for Roxanne Shanté we were actually able to shoot on film, and both of them got on to 120 minutes, which they didn't know what to do with hip-hop at MTV back in those days. So anything that was like not mainstream ended up on 120 minutes.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. Eventually they came up with Yo MTV Raps, but in the early days, if it was something that didn't fit any of the formats, it somehow ended up at 120 minutes. So we would stay up to like 2 in the morning or 1:45 or whenever this stuff would eventually see the light of day. And that's how I got started, you know. Honestly, I Chris and I had big aspirations, and I personally thought I was going to move right into directing from there, but it didn't happen for me. You know, I can remember we came up to New York, and none of the record companies that were around then even had VHS players in their offices, none of the hip-hop labels. And that's where we were going, because now we had this, you know, we had two hip-hop videos. How do we get some work? So we literally walked around Manhattan, and this is like 1985-ish, with a VHS player under our arm and holding a TV set with the cords dragging behind us. And we would walk into people's offices and play it for them. But, you know, nobody was spending money on hip-hop videos back then. Mm-hmm. You know, hip-hop was still not very... You know, there was the Beastie Boys and it was Run DMC, but the major record labels were not spending any money on hip-hop videos at that point. So I kind of put everything on hold and moved to New York and started working on independent features and eventually got into the Directors Guild all within a couple of years as an assistant director. Kind of really learned a lot and really built my chops, you know, from learning how to put a professional production together through how to see a project through completion.
Let me ask you real quick, where does Chiba and the Piper fit into this?
So if we did Roxanne and Schooly in 85, in 89, 4 years later, I'm just now in the Directors Guild, and Chris Schwartz is now just now getting his own record label deal. And he called me up and he said, "Hey, man, I can finally give you another video. It's been 4 years, but we have an opportunity to do some really cool things. I got to deal with Columbia Records." And I said, "Well, I'll take a week. I'm supposed to start this film in the middle of September, but I'm off the last 2 weeks of August. I'll come down to Philly and do a couple of videos." He wanted to do two. The first one was for a group called Blackmail, and the other one was for, honestly, can't remember the name of the group, but Tough Crew was another one. So I came down to Philly, and fully expecting it was going to be, you know, two one-offs, and I would be back to being an assistant director, and I wasn't even back in New York a week. He was saying he had showed the rough cuts to somebody, and he might have a bigger gig for me in New York. And this is before Chiba now. And I'm like, "Oh, okay, where do I go? Who do I meet?" So he sent me to this guy's office in New York, and a guy named Gene Griffin. And next thing you know, I was directing a video to The New Jack Swing by Rex and Effect.
Whoa.
And that was probably the fourth video I did professionally after really starting to do them in 1989. And everybody and their brother was in that video. You know, Cool Moe Dee, Heavy D and the Boys, Keith Sweat. It was everybody.
Al B. Shore was in that video.
Everybody. We filmed it on a rooftop in East Harlem. It was, you know, the whole thing was just edging on the verge of complete disorder. But we got it done. It was a big hit. And Motown was really happy with it, and Chris was able to then use that to get me bigger gigs with Columbia, and that led to the Chiba video.
Wow. Now, the Chiba one, it's interesting because it doesn't sort of speak in the usual hip-hop vernacular for music videos where, I mean, there was a whole lot of CSA in those days, but the Piper I mean, it's. I don't want to say that it's abstract, but it's. You built sets. It's definitely different.
Well, the Piper video. I mean, first off, Chiba was a really interesting guy. But if you remember a group called Digital Underground, Chiba was in their camp.
Oh, okay.
So this was a Humpty song that didn't get made by Humpty.
Okay.
And Chiba was his buddy, mm-hmm. so he gave Chiba the song.
Oh, okay.
And so it had that sort of vibe to it, you know. When Chris played it for me, I was like, okay, this is a no-brainer. I mean, the script is there. And you know, I mentioned earlier I had worked at a repertory cinema when I was in college. And some of the stuff it was probably as good an education in film as going to film school was. So I remember we had a week we were running German Expressionist films from the 20s. And for some reason, you know, when I listened to the Chiba song, I just started thinking of these German – what if rap met German Expressionism? So I came up with this idea to do a German Expressionist rap video. And we had a decent budget. I think it was maybe $30,000, which was enormous at that time, quite honestly, for a rap video, for a brand new artist.
Now, let me ask you real quick. Did you get any pushback from wanting to make it in black and white?
No, Chiba was – Chiba – everyone even then realized you needed to do something unique to stand out, you know, because, I mean, to me, that was the fun period of hip-hop. Nevertheless, there was still a lot of sameness, you know. So what are you going to do to make it different, you know? And since the lyrics and the approach of the song are so different, I think they were feeling what I was saying about doing something, you know, completely unique. So to answer your question about building sets, I mean, we couldn't build sets because even though we had $30,000, that's not enough money to build sets. So I met this really great art director, this guy named John Pano, who went on to great success to be art director, a lot of large motion pictures with Tom McCarthy. He did Station Agent, for instance. But this is before – this is early in his career. So I brought my idea to John, and John said, well, there's only one way we can do this. And I said, well, how's that? And he's like, well, we'll paint it. We won't build it. We'll paint it. So he literally got an overhead projector and designed the set and drew it on a transparent, one of those old-fashioned projectors, drew a transparency, projected it on the psych wall, and said, and since we were only filming in black and white, told his crew to trace it out and then paint only the black parts. So the rest was white already.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we accentuated that with just a lot of wide-angle lenses, forced perspective. The DP, David Waterston, you know, everybody was experimenting then because, you know, music videos then, they weren't giving you in budget. You got back in creative control. So David goes, I wanted to try this Dolly and Zoom Out. You know, let's do a Dolly and Zoom Out. And there was some film at the time that was using that a lot as one of the techniques. And
that's sort of a Spielberg shot, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So we did like three or four of those with wide angle lens throughout and then the forced perspective painted set. And very minimal construction, like a door hanging in space, you know, just a few little three-dimensional elements we brought in, you know, and some props.
Sure.
And then the rest, of course, was casting. You know, I wanted, you know, Coney Island, man. I wanted, you know, this really rich and interesting cast of characters.
That's great. That's great. And I encourage people go on the web and check out The Piper by Chiba. It's a great video. And it's really sort of the time as well, because even though there's the art direction that you have going and it's black and white, it's very stylized, it's still – they're still in the same sort of hip-hop clothing, and there's certain pieces of it that are really of the time.
It was actually, you know, it was a real it really kickstarted me my directing career. I mean, New Jack Swing was huge for me, but the Chiba video probably got me more recognition among creative types at record companies because it was so unique. In fact, I remember hearing that Russell Simmons thought it was the best rap video he had ever seen up to that point. That was secondhand, but someone told me that. I'm sure he saw it much better later along the way. But 1989 or whereabouts, he thought that was kind of state of the art.
Now, what was the next step? I mean, everybody needs a hit. So where did you go from this sort of era?
Well, a hit didn't come right away. You know, I got a reputation for doing really interesting videos with not much money. You know, you do something like that and you get offered a lot more of the same. Unfortunately, is, you know, unique as the Chiba video was, it wasn't a hit and at all. And so I got hired to do the paint it set thing three or four more times, you know. And we kind of ran it into the ground eventually, you know. The sets kept getting more elaborate and we started actually building elements and everything was Munchkinville, you know. And it really wasn't where, I mean, the offers were coming and major labels were cutting checks. So I did, you know, probably four videos with John Pano, the art director, all with that vibe. It was like, how are we going to do it this time? And I kicked around New York for probably another 2 years doing lots of stuff and making a really nice living for someone who was just starting their directing career, but no big hits, you know. And then
you know, it's funny that you say that because for people to contemplate the fact that you had $30,000 to shoot a music video,
yeah.
And it wasn't a hit, and then you get another job, and it's probably an equal or
yeah.
you know, budget or so. It's incredible. I mean, nowadays that's just so unheard of for an unproved artist in an yeah. unknown world.
It was an industry. You know, if you see these old Hollywood movies where, you know, you got the movie executives sitting across the room from the writer and he throws a script at him and he goes, don't think too hard, just make it. There was a pipeline to fill, you know. There was MTV and record labels had these huge, pipelines to fill. You know, everything got a video and So it was like churn them out, you know. Not everything got $30,000. I mean, I was making good videos. It wasn't if I was making bad videos, they would have stopped giving me $30,000. But you know, on the economics of making a music video, when you make maybe 10% of the budget as a director, if you're lucky, you know, making one $30,000 video a month or even one every 6 weeks is, you know, you're not getting rich, you know.
Now let me ask you at this time. Did you see the record company's marketing area start to change at all once music video became a part of a permanent part of the equation?
Well, I mean, it was like I said, it was an industry. So there were all these sort of things that you would equate with that sort of arrangement, which is, you know, artists had it written into their contracts; they were guaranteed a certain number of videos.
Oh, okay.
So you'd have acts that were probably already on the downside with labels that had come out with their first record, but and they were going to come out with a second record, and the label was obligated to do a video for the first single from the second record. So a lot of, I mean, it was, they were churning them out. I'm not sure. Can you ask the question again?
Well, what I'm saying is that I know. As each year progressed and as MTV's,
yeah.
You know, their track record was set, if you had one on there, if you got it into rotation, you were going to get on the pop charts in some way.
Well, there was, yeah, no guarantees. You know, I mean, I don't think there's too many instances of a song that nobody really cared about having a great video and the great video broke the song.
Right.
I think there was a... definitely a synergistic relationship between the video and the song, where you had a song that could make it and you had a video that was great, and it could certainly help solidify that, you know.
I guess my question is, at what point did it feel like the record company and the marketing people were starting to want to have some say in what you were doing?
From the beginning.
Oh, really?
I mean, well, from
I guess from a creative standpoint, yeah. is what I mean.
Quite honestly, the budget determined that. So, you know, my breakthrough video was Crisscross, Hip Jump, right?
Right.
And that was a hip-hop video. The label liked them. Chris Schwartz liked them. Nobody was doing cartwheels, believe it or not. They thought, you know, this could go somewhere, you know. Mm-hmm. So I got hired to do video. They spent $20,000 on it.
Now, as I recall, they wanted to do something more conceptual, and I think you looked at these guys and said,
"Well, this is going to tie into your to what you were saying, you know." So initially I had a meeting with the record label and the band's manager, who I already knew from another project, and they told me what they would like, and you know, they for $20,000 they're not going to be super forceful. They're going to want to know what my ideas are too. They want me to be enthusiastic about doing it. So, but it was more their idea than my idea. And quite honestly, the concept was a stretch, and it was too elaborate for the budget and too elaborate for what the song really needed. So I got to Atlanta, and I met Chris and Chris, and I watched them do a rehearsal and saw them perform for me personally for the first time. And I can't remember. I guess we're just at the verge of cell phones at that point. Maybe we weren't. But I probably ran to the phone in the office afterwards. I called Chris Schwartz in Philly, who then conferenced in someone from the Columbia Records in New York. I said, listen, you don't need this elaborate concept. All you need is these two little kids, and keep the environment and the trappings of the video as simple as possible. And because of the size of the budget, they were amenable to that. You know, 6 months later, they've got a number one hit on MTV. They're spending four times that much on the next video. The record company was a lot more assertive with what they expected out of the video. So it was really related to budget.
You ended up doing like seven videos for them, didn't you?
I did seven videos for Criss Cross.
Now, what happened with – didn't you have a weather issue with Warm It Up?
It was actually Jump.
Oh, Jump. Okay.
Yeah. Which was that was the other part of the equation, which was a lot of the video, as the band had seen it, as the manager had seen it, as the label had seen it, was going to happen outside. And snow was forecast, like, for the only time in anyone's recent memory in Atlanta, 6 inches of snow. this was probably January of 1992 or 3, as I remember. And sure enough, it snowed. And so we actually were able to – the only studio we could get was a photography studio. There were only a couple film studios in Atlanta at that point in time. It wasn't as big a film capital as it is now. But there were a couple professional studios, and neither of them was available. So what we did was someone who knew someone knew someone who had a still photography studio. And, you know, it was maybe a 12 or 15-foot psych wall. And we went in, and that's where we shot the video, most of it, except the scenes that we shot outside, which were very confined.
And you're in the snow.
Yeah. We had a lowrider. The lowrider had to be in the video.
Okay. Why?
Well, because it jumps.
Oh, okay. Got it. Of course.
It was a great great companion to the song. So we contacted the owner of the only – such car in Atlanta. There's millions of them in LA, but only a few in Atlanta. And he said, "No, I'm not doing this. The car will get ruined in the snow." So we managed to talk him into driving it just out. We shoveled outside the garage where the car was parked. And we drove it out and put it in front of the wall that was the garage wall in the space that we shoveled, and shot the whole scene. It was great, you know. I like the simplicity of it. The car is doing its thing. It's against a brick wall, and the two kids are there. It worked perfectly.
Now, don't you have a backward pants story?
Yeah. Well, halfway through the video, the DP of the video of Jump, that is, Nick Kaufman and I went into the men's room at lunch and put our pants on backwards. And and that was pretty much when we hit hyperdrive with the video, because everyone loved that, and we were all on the same page after that. We went in shortly after and put them on correctly, because it was impossible to work that way. But very uncomfortable, but because our pants weren't three or four sizes too big. But the story goes that my sister asked me at Thanksgiving dinner the next year whose idea it was for them to wear their pants backwards. And I told her it was my idea. you know, being kind of very tongue-in-cheek, and she didn't follow up and question it. And then I found out a couple of years after that that it circulated all over South Jersey that it was my idea. I had been the one to instruct Crisscross to wear their pants backwards.
How funny. Okay, well, we're gonna play a little bit of Crisscross. We're here with Rich Murray, a fantastic music video director. We're going to talk a little bit more about the rest of his career. But in the meantime, let's warm it up. Crisscross, warm it up. We're here with Rich Murray, director extraordinaire from that era. We're so happy to be talking about this era of music video, which we like to do every first Sunday here on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm Stephen Pitalo, and we are back with Music Video Time Machine. Rich, as I understand it, your music video career took an interesting sort of left turn as a result of being in New York. How did you go from directing hip-hop videos to being associated with the Spin Doctors?
Well, you know, everything in the music business is synergy, you know? I mean, it's who knows the person that you want to know and what how are they connected? It was back then anyway. Now it's much different, of course. But there was this manager, David Sonnenberg, very famous guy in the New York music scene, who had the Fugees. And they hadn't yet signed, but Chris Schwartz was talking to him about the Fugees and about some other groups as well. And he said, "Yeah, I got this group called the Spin Doctors. You probably heard of them. They had, you know, just had this big hit, Little Miss Can't Be Wrong. I got to find somebody really cool to do a video for them, but the record label don't want to spend a lot of money. So, you know, they're playing my song, right?" So Chris nominated me for the job, and David said he would meet with me. And you know, Chris Cross is now number one on MTV at about this time. So it didn't take too much convincing, you know. I present myself, you know, as someone who you don't have to really squint your eyes and say, could this guy do a rock video, you know. I really have a lot of love for hip-hop, but, you know, my first love was always rock music. You'd be surprised on how difficult that is, though, you know, especially at a record label level, to convince people that, you know, you've been working in this one genre and now you can work in another genre. But David took the leap of faith, and I didn't find this out till maybe a little later, that he wanted a little bit of a hip-hop feel to the video. He wanted it that sort of storytelling, that sort of tongue-in-cheek storytelling you were seeing in those early 90 videos, you know. Whether it was
Sort of a visual element to
it. Yeah. Yeah. He didn't want heroic. He wanted fun and quirky.
Okay.
You know, Bon Jovi was doing heroic, you know.
you were going to go the way of Hard Day's Night.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and, you know, I had evidence that I could handle black and white and bring off a black and white video, I think, very well with the Chiba video and some others I did as well. So, yeah. So I pitched this idea, you know, the whole video would be kind of a homage to Hard Day's Night. And they loved it, you know. And it didn't hurt that Bismarcky was supposed to be in the video as well.
Oh, this is for Two Princes.
This is for Two Princes.
Okay.
Bismarcky, unfortunately, didn't show up. And the guy who plays his part in the video is actually his bodyguard, who did show up. who became a huge, you know, a huge MTV, recognizable MTV star for about 6 minutes as a result.
And didn't he come track you down?
He did, yeah. Well, not in a bad way, but he just couldn't. Like many of us who were all over the television back then, weren't getting paid hardly any money, he just couldn't believe that he could have this much exposure and such a small paycheck could be associated with it. But that was the sad reality.
Now, how many videos did you end up doing for them? Because I know that you ended up doing Two Princes. You did
I didn't do Little Miss Can't Be Wrong, but I did How Could You Want Them.
How Could You Want Them When You Knew You Could Have Me?
Yeah, What Time Is It?
Right.
Yeah, and a bunch of others. Mary Jane. Probably 5 or 6 total.
Did you say you didn't do You Let Your Heart Go Too Fast, or you did?
I did do that, yes.
Oh, you did? Oh, okay.
I did them all for, you know, like Crisscross. I did one, and then I did them all for a period of time until I stopped doing any.
Oh, okay.
And then it was time to use, you know, quite honestly, most acts back in those days were working with multiple directors. It was unusual.
Now, you were going to see the Spin Doctors, basically, at the...
I had known the Spin Doctors since 1989.
Okay.
And in fact, just more kind of tentacles here, I had taken Chris Schwartz to see them at the Continental before they were signed by Epic.
Oh, wow.
And they knew me from hanging out at the Continental, this Continental Divide on 3rd Avenue in East Village. And, you know, Chris probably had the same genre problem I had. You know, he brought a rock track up to Columbia when they were thinking of him as a hip-hop guy, you know. So... Ironically, Epic signed them a year or two after that. But so I'd known them that far back, yeah, but not well. You know, they knew me from around. You know,
okay, cool. But one of the things about the Spin Doctors is that I've always said that, you know, every decade gets its bar band, and in the '80s it was Huey Lewis, and in the '90s it seemed like it was the Spin Doctors.
Yeah, I mean, the Spin Doctors are in my opinion, you know, some of the most amazing musicians out there that I've ever worked with. The irony is that not many people would make that association. I mean, when I used to go see the Spin Doctors in the early days, they were a blues band. I mean, they still are, at heart, are still a blues band. In fact, they just made a blues record a couple of years ago that I think did really well and charted on the Billboard blues charts.
Yeah.
But, you know, they did a couple really commercially successful singles, and that kind of, it's genre. You know, everybody starts to associate you with a certain thing, and for the Spin Doctors, they got associated with pop music. So it kind of derailed them, their career as.
Nice problem to have. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And the things that I always liked about the Spin Doctors videos that you did with How Could You Want Them When You Know You Could Have Me and What Time Is It is that, as I understood, you basically had one budget to do the both of those.
Yeah.
And you did one as a story, and you did one as more of a concert. What Time Is It is basically their European tour, isn't it?
Yeah. It was right after Two Princes, and the band had already – they had a follow-it up, and the band already booked a pretty extensive European tour. So it was like it all happened in about 10 minutes, you know. I went to see them at the Whiskey A Go-Go, and the record label people were backstage, and they said, hey, you want to go to Europe and – do a couple of videos while you're over there with the Spin Doctors. And I said, sure, you know. And then we came up with the idea of doing, you know, one kind of a more controlled concept video and the other one being kind of fast and loose touring video. And this is before all the digital gear that exists now. So we shot everything on film, and we couldn't afford multiple cameras. So we shot everything with one camera plus a Bolex with them playing live and fixed, basically sunk it up in post. And we would get one take every sound check, where I would pretty much stand right in front of Chris, the lead singer, and shoot what I knew would be a master that I could cut to of him performing the song.
Sure.
Yeah. But everything else was complete winged, totally winged.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I always loved this particular track. This is Spin Doctors with What Time Is It?
Not me.
Yeah, the Spin Doctors with What Time Is It? I'm here with Rich Murray, a music video director who shot several clips for Spin Doctors. We were just talking a little bit about what it was sort of like at that time. And because the music industry is such a different sort of animal now, well, what is it that that you'd like people to know about, you know, that particular time? What it was sort of like?
Well, it was a lot of fun, first off, but it was I would say very fast and loose as far as the creative process. You know, I mean, as I said earlier, everything was related to budget. So if you're working under a certain budget level, you had kind of the ability to, you know, make something great or really screw something up, you know. And if you moved into commercials or you moved into videos with budgets over $100,000, they started looking at things very closely and stick to the script and, you know, this is what you promised, this is what you need to deliver. But when you got under a certain budget level, you know, you kind of it was a lot of fun. It was really just an extension of film school for me for a long time, where you kind of just played the hand you were dealt, and sometimes came up with some really great results. The Spin Doctor, What Time Is It video, the hotel room, for instance, was a room in the village where we shot the other video. And the producer came up to me and said, I just looked at the schedule. There's no way we're going to be able to get a shoot in a hotel room while we're shooting this What Time Is It video. And I said, well, we need the hotel room. So we sent a search party out into the village to find out if anyone had a room in any of their houses that we could shoot for a hotel room. And literally props were gathered throughout the village to make it look like a hotel room. And we shot the hotel room right then and there in the village where we were shooting the How Could You Want Him video. And that's kind of – there was a lot – I mean, the two Princes video was supposed to be shot at the band shell along the FDR. I think it's gone now. There was a band shell there in that park along the FDR. And it was all graffitied up, and that was where we decided to shoot the video, the performance part of it anyway. And like about 3 days before the video, we got a message from the mayor's office saying that they didn't think it was structurally sound enough or safe enough to permit a film crew in there, and they were canceling our permit. So someone told me there was a band shell in Central Park, which I had remembered was being there, as being there. So dead of night, it was my birthday. I remember it very distinctly, November 27th, 1992. We went into Central Park in complete darkness looking for this band shell, and we turned the wrong way. And we found the location we ended up using, Bethesda Fountain. We could have turned right, and the band shell would have been right there. We get out of the cab, and we turned left, and we walked to Bethesda Fountain. And I said, well, why don't we just do it here? And no one challenged me. It was that sort of time.
Oh, that's it's so funny because in Central Park, what's so interesting is you watch the video now, and it looks like it was shot yesterday. Because there's some sets and there's some areas, they just don't change.
Yeah.
There's no different. Now, as I understand it, you headed to Nashville for a little while and worked with some artists down there.
Yeah, one thing leads to another, you know, like I said, in the music business. And the Two Princes video was, you know, very big crossover hit. And like any genre, the people in country music are always looking to broaden their horizons. So a couple of the artists down there said, hey, find some pop directors who are willing to work with us. So, I'd done one of the number one hip-hop videos, the number one pop videos in the same year, Criss Cross and Spin Doctors. So I went down and it led to me doing 10, 15 videos in Nashville, including Billy Ray Cyrus and Mark Chestnut and a bunch of others.
And didn't Billy Ray Cyrus call you the Yankee director?
Yes, he did. He called me his Yankee director. That was a funny – I mean, the video I shot with him was a bunch of Harleys in a park on the 4th of July. It was 95 degrees. And I remember Billy Ray Cyrus saying, our Yankee director just turned green. And that was the last thing I heard before I passed out. You know, I passed out from the heat. I was on the back of a camera car.
Oh, my gosh. That's funny.
But he called me his Yankee director kind of affectionately after that. But it was an interesting experience.
Now, can you talk a little bit about the projects that you're working on right now?
Well, I'm working on a documentary about Alan Mann, who I directed my very first video for in 1993. Alan, beyond Christmas on the Block, which, you know, was my association with him, was an amazing musician and songwriter who never really made it. He was always going to be the next guy to make it out of Philly. And he died kind of tragically in his early 30s, kind of in ironic fashion, because the circumstances of his death were very much followed the lyrics to one of his songs. But it was a complete accident. He had to jump out of a window to avoid a fire. And died from the fall.
Oh, my goodness.
And one of his largest hit outside of Christmas on the Block was Fear of Heights.
Whoa.
Yeah. But that's coincidence aside, he's a really interesting guy with an enormous body of work. And, you know, I started doing kind of a little bit of a memoir, a short film about me making this video, Christmas on the Block, 30 years ago. But it's turned into a much larger biopic about Alan's entire life. It's called No Deal, No Sleep, The Life and Times of Alan Mann.
And about what percentage of it would you say is done at this point, and what's the future hold for this?
I filmed probably about 70%, 75% of the interviews. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a sort of a graphic novel animation aspect to it.
Okay.
You know, as opposed to kind of going towards what I would think to be, you know, corny recreations.
Sure.
Because there's not much on film to really tell the story, other than a few performances of Alan's, some behind-the-scenes footage from the video I directed. There wasn't a time when people had, you know, film cameras out all the time and, you know, documenting every move you made. So to kind of add a visual aspect to the storytelling beyond Alan's performances and beyond the interviews, there's going to be a graphic novel sort of depiction of some events in Alan's life.
Wow. Now, where can people catch up with you sort of on the web and check out the things you're working on?
Well, I'm just kind of reinvigorating my company, Attention Films. I work doing some other things as well these days, but I've just really returned to filmmaking with this Alan project for the first time in 5 or 7 years. So attentionfilms.com is my website, and there's some footage up from a documentary I was making about the Spin Doctors a bunch of years ago that may yet be completed, as well as there will be footage soon from the upcoming Alan Mann doc, as well as a lot of my classic videos are on that site as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Rich Murray, for being a guest on Music Video Time Machine. Loved your work and loved hearing some of the stories that you had to tell us.
My pleasure, Stephen. It was a lot of fun.
All right. Once again, this is Stephen Patallo, and you're listening to Music Video Time Machine on Radio Free Brooklyn. We've got some more fantastic stuff coming up so very soon. Remember, you can catch Music Video Time Machine every first Sunday at 4 p.m. here on Radio Free Brooklyn. Hope to see you guys again soon.